television nerds. My name is Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Dagan Fricklin. Dagan is creator for TV, executive producer, and showrunner for the series Bitten, based on the Otherworld novels by Kelly Armstrong. She's also worked on Motive, The Listener, Being Erica, The Guard, J-Pod, Robson Arms, Falcon Beach, and Cold Squad. Dagan won a Leo Award for Best Dramatic Series Screenwriting for J-Pod and was nominated as a producer for Best Drama Series for Motive at the 2014 Canadian Screen Awards. The feature film Edison and Leo, which she co-wrote, won Best Animated Feature at the Bangkok International Animation Film Festival. She's also written animated television for YTV, Studio B, Family Channel, and Teletoon. We talk about all of that and a little place called Frightenstein in my conversation with Dagan Fricklin. Thanks for coming on the podcast this week. I appreciate you putting aside some time for the Ramble Fest that I know has become the ABC's podcast of TV.
Well, you're welcome. And as a true writer form, it's an awesome procrastination vehicle. I'm in the middle of writing the studio draft of the season finale.
Oh.
So I've swept the floor. I've walked the dog. We've done laundry today. And so this is very, very helpful.
So let me just dive right before we get to anything, because I'm interested in the track already. You're in the middle of writing something. What's process for you of when you know you've got something that you got to get done? What's that process? It sounds like you've kind of structured your day around this, as opposed to, I'm just going to sit down when the inspiration hits me.
Well, when you're in the middle of production, there's no such thing as waiting for inspiration to hit you. You kind of have to force it through. And also that's when you're in the middle of production, and especially when you're show running, there's no such thing as a day off either. I think since the beginning of April, I've had one weekend day off. Mm-hmm. You're just constantly writing and revising things and coming up with ideas, and you're constantly inside the machine. There's this quote that from Downton Abbey, mm-hmm. where the Lady Dowager says, the Dowager Countess says, "What's a weekend?" And I say that all the time too, but for the complete opposite reason why neither of us know what a weekend is.
So
she's in perpetual Saturday. I'm in perpetual Wednesday. And if only that meant every day was an actual hump day, but it's not. Maybe I'm the one being humped, but no.
maybe we'll wait for later in the episode for going into details on that. I don't know if we're there yet quite. I'm not sure. So I am curious though, because I am somebody who's, whereas Diane, who's on the podcast with me, and Greg, who does the regular podcast with me, they have loads of experience in Canadian television. I'm podcast guy. I'm creative guy. So I'm hoping that I kind of bring the fan perspective to this. And so I'm wondering, when you sit, how much of what you sit down and write in your apartment today, how much of percentage wise of that is going to make it to the final draft?
Oh gosh, I hope 100%.
Does it get redone, adds, edits, all of that stuff?
Well, it depends. It depends on the script, and it depends on where you are in the season. I mean, the tough part about the finale is that everything is resting on the finale. All the balls that you've thrown up in the air, you have to juggle and then catch in a graceful way in the finale. And so it's the one that has the most pressure put on it. It's the one that, the network is most excited and anxious about, and it's the one where the actors are all going to want, and as showrunner too, want to give them their awesome moments in that episode and have everything pay off in a seamless way so that we can close out the season, but also then tip us towards what we're setting up for season three.
Right. So let's be clear, because we haven't done this yet. This is season two finale.
Yes.
That you're writing right now. So as I read, and tell me if I'm wrong, it was a 10 episode season?
10 episode season, yeah. Last season was 13. This season is 10. I love 10 episode season. It's a much more compact, obviously. The storytelling device is faster and livelier, and yeah, like we can really just keep a great clip to our pace as we're going through these episodes. It's not a lot of downtime.
Now, the issue that I've had sometimes in the past, not with just season finales in general, is when you're writing the season finale, you don't know if you're greenlit for the next season yet. You hope you all things could point to yes, but how much do you have to consider when you're writing a season finale, or do you even consider? You just be optimistic that this is where we're going season three, and that's how we're going to do it.
Yeah, just pure optimism.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, if worse comes to worse, and you don't get renewed, then if you've cliffhangers, then that creates a fan expectation and fan base that's sort of driving that desire for the next season, because they want to see what's going to happen. We have incredible fans on this show. Yeah. We've built really great relationships with our fans too, and we're Space's top rated original series, and that's because of our incredible fan base, and they're very vocal and they're very passionate about the show.
Right. So I mean, writing the great cliffhanger is even more of an inspiration to the fans. They become almost a tool for motivation for the network, so to speak.
I guess so. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a really sort of synergistic relationship that we have with them and with the network, and building up the base of viewership for this show.
How do you think, to me, that would seem to have just changed over the past, really over the past decade in the long view, but really over the past 4 to 5 years in the short view, where a fan base would come on so hard and strong after a single season of a show, in some cases a couple of episodes of a show. All of a sudden, social media, social networking, and a television show kind of became one because of the long-term story arc, and that's kind of when it hit. I'm wondering if that's when you noticed it too.
Yeah, for sure, because I was a big fan of Lost, and also frustrated by Lost. I think you can't be a fan without that sort of hand-holding of fandom and frustration. So it was one of the first shows where I went to the internet. There was some great viral marketing that they did with the mystery and trying to unlock the clues, and they had a pretty cool website, and a lot of fan chat rooms around what was happening and people trying to unlock the mystery of the island. And that was really cool. And then, as a writer here in Canada, it's funny because our Twitter fan base and Twitter's changed everything as a creator of a show and as a viewer of a show, like that ability to interact live and do like live tweeting and live streaming and everything has really just changed it all. And the access that fans have to the cast and to the crew is, just cracked everything open. Because before, when it was Lost, it was because, Lost premiered 10 years ago. It was the chat rooms.
Yeah.
And there wasn't that same sort of interaction live and in the moment, especially not with the creators of the show. I mean, I remember being on shows back then, and you would look at the fan chat rooms on things like J-Pod and being Erica, but I never wanted to interact with anyone.
Right.
For starters, it wasn't my show. I didn't feel like I could so much be a spokesperson for the show. But also just that immediacy of being in a conversation with someone didn't exist in the chat or just in the sort of forums. But now with Twitter, the immediacy of that means you can just, pop a response off to someone and they'll see it because it's directly to them. And it's, it's just a conversation now with fans.
I mean,
our Canadian fans on Twitter are actually more active than our American fans. Our American fans sort of feed onto a different website.
Right.
Called TV Tag. But the Canadian ones are really active, both and on Motive too, because last season I did an episode on Motive, and on season one I did two episodes. So, I was live tweeting along with that show as well. And on that show as well, a lot more Twitter feed from Canadians than when the American broadcast is on.
Is it at all in your mind now when you're writing a show, especially a show, like you say, with this very involved fan base that gets involved in social networking? Do you have to intentionally keep it out of your head when you're writing, or do you embrace it and say, you know what, if I leave the episode here, they're going to love that for the next week?
Oh, we absolutely talk about that when we're breaking episodes. We have a word that we use called floof. And that's when women are going to tear their clothes off when Grayston does something sexy, or Steve Lund does something sexy, or Greg, or Michael Xavier, that it's a floof moment. And we can see these happen on Twitter as people are watching the show, that they react to certain things, or a heart moment when there's some, you know, very romantic thing happens. Or we have another thing called the vest of ass kickery. And this is a article of clothing that Greg Brick wears as Jeremy, our alpha. So it's like, oh yeah, they're going to comment on that. So we do really, you know, we don't build story around these things, but we do acknowledge when we hit these beats as we're breaking story, oh yeah, that's going to get a good react. Like, they're going to love that.
I've often thought, and does it get down this deep that you try and find a catchphrase or a line during the episode that will neatly fit into 140 characters?
Don't do that intentionally, but our network space, they make these beautiful Twitter postcards that go along with the live tweeting, and they're able to do that. They're able to find the catch lines throughout the episode.
Yeah, I find the interaction that's happening now, it's not that I can't do it, I won't do it. Like, when I sit down to watch something, I sit down to watch something. And don't get me wrong, I'm on Twitter all the time, but usually not when I'm intensely watching a show. Like, I want to devote my time to that. But I appreciate the fact that other people are doing that. My fear is that at some point over the next 5 years, it's going to come onto the screen. It's going to come onto my main screen, and I'm not going to be able to get rid of it. It's going to be a constant crawl across the bottom of the screen.
So funny, though, you know, because I started going to, you know, I went to Banff Television Comp, the festival.
Right.
Oh, gosh, the first time I went there was maybe 15 years ago, and I was working for a feature film production company called Cadence Entertainment. It was based out in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And there was all this talk then of the way that the media were going to converge, and that we were going to have pop-up windows on our television screen, and we'd be able to interact that way. And that was 15 years ago, and that was like, this is going to happen tomorrow, and it's still, you know, the live tweeting is the closest that we've gotten to it.
Right.
At least in my Luddite world. And I agree with you. That's the closest I want to get to it. I want to be able to have an experience where I get to choose whether I want to interact with people, because I do it with shows that I work on. I enjoy live tweeting with the shows that I work on because I love seeing the fan response to what we've put out there.
Right.
And our actors join in too. And, you know, it creates a really nice community. But if I'm watching something that I didn't create or write on, I'm not live tweeting usually.
Right. I think that's what I find too. I don't mind the two side by side, but I'm hoping never the twain shall meet, so to speak.
Yeah.
So let's maybe leave Bitten for a second. We'll come back to it at the end, but I'm curious to know, the path for you in getting to where you're at now. So, where are you from originally? Are you from Toronto or Vancouver?
Oh, there's the sirens. Yes. If you're playing along with podcast bingo, that's 069 right there.
Exactly. Well, oh yes, 06 under the O, 69.
Well, oh, I'm from Vancouver.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been told a distinctly Vancouver accent. So I'll say things like, "Yeah, we took the boat to Poets Cove," and then nobody understands what I just said in the room, which is we took the boat to Poets Cove.
I understood that. I think most Canadians from Ontario to BC can understand each other pretty well.
Sweet. Well, I would say sweet, but now that I'm in Ontario, I'll say beauty.
do we even say beauty anymore?
would totally do. Ontarians probably say beauty.
And there's, I mean, for the 2 decades now, there's been booming film and television happening in Vancouver. Is that kind of when the big boom was happening right in the 90s. Is that kind of when you got your start?
I can't remember dates. I can remember shows. So the first show that I worked on I started in animation.
Okay.
And that's where I actually met Dennis Heaton.
That's actually becoming a theme on this show, is a lot of people who got their start in animation, but Canada is so well known for animation. And so
Vancouver was really, you know, there's a lot of animation there. It's a good place to get your start too, because when I started, I was working on a show called What About Mimi. Victor Nicole was the head writer on that show at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was 11 minute format. So it was great. Like, you just learn how to write an A plot and that's it. And so it was a great learning experience for me. And then I wrote for a couple of their other shows there, Yvonne of the Yukon, and a toddler show called Something Else, and Yakety Yak. And I had met Pete Mitchell previous to this, because I was trying to get into Cold Squad as their story department intern.
Mm-hmm.
So, BC Film had an internship program at the time where you join a story department as their coordinator. And he didn't hire me that year, but he remembered me for the next year when he needed a writer to come on board. So we met. I pitched him this crazy episode about bum fights. And because that, you know, working with animators all day, you're exposed to this crazy stuff. So there was a copy of Bum Fights, which was this VHS that these two guys from San Diego had just gone out and paid homeless people like $5 a shot to fight each other, and then videotaped it. And then they ended up getting sued by somebody who was, you know, quite injured doing this.
You were on the cusp of the bum fight genre even before YouTube exploded it, I believe.
Yeah, because it was VHS. It was circulating VHS tapes at that time. Oh, God, I'm so old. it was back in the day of the VHS. So I pitched that episode to him. He dug it, ended up directing it, and so brought me on to Cold Squad for a season. So then I, you know, went from writing animation to writing live action, which was bonkers. Like, it, all of a sudden, the first day that we were shooting on a soundstage with actors and this whole machine making this happen, and it's like, oh God, I just put a bunch of bullshit on a page and now everybody's taking it seriously, and this is, you know, this costs a lot of money to do this, and they all trusted that these things that I put on a page were the things that they should actually be saying and lighting and, you know, buying props for and everything. It was incredibly intimidating, and yet, wow, I had this feeling, I didn't know what it was. I stepped outside, I phoned my mom, and she said, "You're proud."
That's the high, and right?
It was really I mean, incredible to see it all come, and such an adrenaline rush. I was like, this is it. This is the thing. This is the drug. Must keep doing this.
Right. And so is that, do you find after, you know, close to a couple of decades of, you know, focusing on writing, doing all that stuff now, is the high still when the script gets to the stage, so to speak, or is it when you're writing it and you come up with that great moment or that great ending, or is there a little bit of both?
It's all of it. Yeah. It's when you've finished writing a line of dialogue that you're like, yeah, that feels right. Or a scene or the whole script. And then when you go onto the soundstage and you see, like, you know, Gaffer has gone out and got a light package to light this thing so that it can happen. And art department is building a set to make it happen. And everybody's moving it forward. And actors have come in and they're embodying the character in the way that you absolutely saw it. And when you write a line of dialogue for an actor and you know, I just have absolute conviction. They know exactly how to deliver this line, and they do, and it's just perfect. And then even in post, when the editors are cutting it together just seamlessly, and then your composer comes in and puts some sort of amazing piece of music to it, like, it just keeps building and building and building, and so that the final cut is, you know, just high fives all around.
When we were talking with Ari Millen on our last episode from Orphan Black, we talked about that interchange between writers and the actors. And as the season goes on or as the series goes on, you get to know each other. It's almost like musicians on a stage. You know, you're almost, to me, I liken it to almost a jazz relationship where one person knows what the other can do. And it's like you kick out a musical idea and they can respond to it.
Yeah. And you can tell too. I mean, we always say, well, this is a script that was written before that person got cast. Or this is a script that was written before we built that set. You have an idea of what the space is going to look like, or what the person is going to be look like, but or what the person is going to be look like, nice one, or what the person is going to bring to the role. But then when you actually step onto the stage, or when you actually are interacting with the actor, then you can fine tune your instruments so that you're all, you know, that there's no discord. It is this sort of communication back and forth with the actors too, of finding that fine tuning. In some cases, they just come in and completely nail it and bring surprises to it as well, which is always really, really lovely when you're surprised by your own words in a way that cracks the character open.
And some of that, I have to imagine, is serendipity, where the actor might read it a certain way and you didn't think of it as being delivered that way. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, that works.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Let's maybe go through what the schedule is like. So if there's people out there who are listening, who are big fans of season one, you went from January until April last year. Is that the plan again for 2015?
I hope so, but we don't have 100% confirmation yet from either network. Because what happened last year, we aired January through March or April, and we were Saturday nights with Space, and that was a great fit for us, and we were Monday nights with Sci-Fi, which was also great. We were on a Monday night Sci-Fi night with Being Human and Lost Girl. So it was a nice, you know, chunk of Canadian broadcasting on an American network.
So you get the green light saying you've got season two, and when do the engines start revving up?
We had a development room in January, and that was 2 weeks, and that was just to sort of break a season overview.
Okay.
No scripts or outlines. And so, and we'd also just been asked sort of very last minute before opening that room to bring the witches into season two.
Okay.
Because that hadn't originally been the intention. Now that we have them, I love them. And I'm so glad that we've brought the witches in for season two. We were going to go off book, slightly further off book, but the fan reaction, the fact that we'd stayed fairly close to the book in season one, just seemed natural for us to bring in more elements from the second book as well. So that we had this room in January for 2 weeks, and then we opened our room officially at the beginning of April.
Okay.
And again, we didn't have scripts or outlines yet. We had an order for 4 scripts out of that April room. And so, and I had a different story department this year as well. Wills Mack and Garfield Miller, who were with me last year, came into this season. And then this season, we folded in Michael McLennan, who was previously from Bomb Girls.
Okay.
Larry Bambrick, who had been on Flashpoint and Cracked before, and Jen Engels, who came to us from a more comedy side of Less Than Kind and Satisfaction.
Right.
And so it was, you know, in the early days, catching them up on the show, the tone of the show, what our plans were for season two, and then just building season two. So we spent about the first 2 or 3 weeks, again, just building out our universe, because bringing in the witches meant we had to create a whole new mythology as well. Like, how does it work? What kind of magic is it? We wanted to stay within the tone of the show, so we didn't want, you know, glowing fireballs flying out of their hands or big witchcraft. We wanted kind of lo-fi Blair Witch kill list kind of creepy witchcraft.
If there's anything a fan's going to catch you out on, it's something that quote unquote shouldn't be there.
Yeah, if it's tonally wrong to the show. And you know, the show wants what the show wants, and that's what it is. And so then we did 4 scripts, and we went to camera in mid August. So I I create a script schedule, delivery schedule very early in the game so that we know what our deadlines are and we can hit those deadlines. I'm a very deadline-driven person. I get nervous when we have to shift that thing around a little bit just because I know the amount of turnaround that's required and how much of a crunch there is. Because as soon as we go to camera, I like to also have a writer on set. The writer who wrote that script, they go to set with their script and they work in conjunction with the director, and they're there as a resource for the director and for the actors and crew and whatever else, because the directors that we have, and thankfully we have some returning directors this season, we also have some new directors, but the writers really understand the continuity of the show. They understand, you know, if a character is saying something just slightly off that might be misinterpreted for where we're taking that person, their character trajectory down the road, or even just small things like if a prop needs to read more prominently in the shot because we're going to pay it off in the next episode. Like, they really have the eye towards that sort of thing.
Sure.
So yeah, as soon as we go to camera, then zoop, one person is, you know, yanked out of the story room and on set, and sometimes two writers because we have second units. And so, yeah, I like to get as much written before we go to camera, or as much of the breaking, as much of the story in place before we go to camera as possible, so that there's not this sort of panic at the last moment of, oh, I got to break the season finale and everybody's on set and I have to now sit in a room with myself and my dog and somehow he's going to Son of Sam this thing to me.
Well, yeah, don't get me wrong, some fantastic things can come out of being forced into doing something. I mean, sometimes the less thinking is better, but that's when you're dealing with as many people as you are, you don't want to feel like you're rushed.
Yes.
You want to feel like the planning's gone into it, right?
But I also, you know, with the season finale, both last year and this year, have sort of put them aside, so that there is a little bit more of a crunch to get it done. Because I don't want to have everything written too soon, because it's nice to see how, you know, new characters are interacting with the cast and where the sort of natural relationships are happening and where the story is going. And because sometimes, as you say, an actor will deliver a line and it's like, ooh, that's juicy. And we hadn't thought of that, but now we can kind of go in this other direction. So you don't want to be gridlocked into a story line that doesn't allow for some serendipity.
Yeah, with the finale especially, I would imagine that you want to be informed as much by the previous episodes of the season as they're shooting as you can.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of good stuff that can happen there.
But for the sake of other departments too, there's that fine balance of, yeah, our line producer's going to want to know, where is this taking place? And our locations guy, so that they can go start looking for the locations for the finale, and, you know, what are the actors that you're going to need in that one, and what are does the art department and production designer, do they need to build a new location on our soundstage for that last one? You know, all these things. What does wardrobe need for that last one? Just so that, because as we're wrapping up the season, they're also looking at, are there, can certain sets that we're using be folded out? Like, do I need all of Stonehaven for the season finale, or are there parts that they can fold out?
You've really crossed a whole bunch of different styles of shows over the past decade or so. And can you telegraph an audience just from that? I mean, you can assume an audience, but can you telegraph an audience? I guess, you know, if it's going to be on a certain channel like Space, you're going to be guessing it's going to have a certain type of audience.
Well, and the other thing too that Space really wanted out of this show was to bring a larger female audience to their network. So that was one of the early considerations when we were first in discussions with Space,
right,
about what the show was going to be. And that was part of the reason why they brought this into development.
Okay.
Was that they, you know, wisely were looking at things like Comic-Con and seeing the amount of women that attend these festivals and thinking, you know, there is some great material and fans are responding to Doctor Who and, you know, other shows. And so is there a way that we can bring that audience to our network as well?
So you take one step or a couple of things away from a show like Bitten, and it's an adventure show. It's an action show. I mean, at its root, that's what it is. It tells a story every week. I mean, but that happens with every show. You take away the hook, let's say, which a lot of shows have, or the small premise, and essentially they just become character-driven adventures, action shows.
Yeah, ours is it's a mafia show, but they're you know, instead of Sopranos, they're werewolves.
So it's got that archetype to it, and is that kind of in the back of the heads of the writers' room when you, like, do the tropes of the mafia show, you know, play on your minds as you're putting it together, or is that maybe just a kickstart point, or, and does it kind of develop into its own thing from there?
In season one, for sure, it was this is a family with skewed morals. This is basically a mafia show,
right?
And they're being challenged by people who want to take their turf. You know, if you're gonna distill it down to the basic non-genre concept that we were working with, and then you add in the genre element, which is it's a pack of werewolves, and their turf is being challenged by rogue werewolves who are sick of having these rules enforced upon them. But the rules ensure that humans are safe, and that there can be this coexistence, and they can retain their secrecy. In season two, it's slightly different because of the interjection now that our other world elements are broadening and the witches are coming in. So season two thematically is more let the right one in. You know, how can you survive if other people know your secret? Are you allowed to bring people in?
Right.
And trust them?
I'm finding like all the shows, and whether it's television shows, whether it's films, whether it's books, it's all about people who would have been considered monsters being integrated into society now.
Mm-hmm.
And that's become so prevalent in a lot of, I think it started with books, and then all of a sudden it's like you're seeing it a lot on television now. And it's hard for me to think of a show now that doesn't have a type of monster that's been somehow integrated into our society. And how would we deal with that if we know about it? We might not know about it, but if we do know about it, how do we deal with that?
Yeah, and in our case too, because, you know, you're with the pack. So theoretically, if you're kind of inside the lair of the monster.
Right.
You're not with the humans looking at the werewolves going, ah, werewolves, monster. You're with the werewolves who are trying to protect their secret so that humans don't come at them with pitchforks.
Let's go back a little bit. One of the questions that I always love asking whenever I'm talking to someone on this podcast is, what television and or films and or pop culture did you consume as you were growing up?
Well, I grew up until the age of 7 in Calgary. And so one of the things that I grew up with was the Buckshot Show. This was a local shot cowboy with a bear named Benny the Bear. It was sort of our... Out in Vancouver, they had J.P. Patches, who was from Seattle.
Yeah.
He was like our friendly giant Mr. Dress-Up kind of guy.
And that was like local television.
That was local television, yeah. And so, and the other thing, because I grew up in Calgary, that I watched a lot of, and because I have two older brothers, was Stampede Wrestling.
Oh, of course.
And so that was actually a good story learning, like good story device there. It's scripted, and it's crazy, yeah. And I, you know, just loved it as a kid. And then, you know, having listened to your podcast with Heaton last week, I'm heartbroken that he didn't have a chance to grow up with Hilarious House of Frightenstein.
Oh, thank you so much for going there.
You know, I think a while ago you guys, or maybe it was Diane, had there was something out there. It was like, what's the best Canadian television show ever made? And I thought, oh yeah, everybody's going to go Beachcombers, 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 or... You know, but for me, it was Hilarious House of Frightenstein. It was these perfect vignettes. Billy Van, amazing. The amount of characters that he could play in every show. You know, I had my favorites. I didn't particularly like the mosquito thing because all mosquito was standing on a giant foot the whole time. And I am, like, incredibly repulsed by feet. So even as a young kid, I was like, ooh, maybe that's where it came from. Maybe it's all started with Hilarious House of Frightenstein. I didn't particularly like the hippie, but I love the Wolfman. I love Igor. I loved going into the witch's lair, and I love story time and Vincent Price. And like my parents would take us to drive-in theater in Calgary when I was a kid, and we had a station wagon, and they would put us in the back to sleep.
Right.
And I remember one time we went to, and there was a Vincent Price movie playing, and I had just peeked up and watched that thing over the back seat, terrified the whole time, completely changed my viewing of Hilarious House of Frightenstein, but in a good way. I had like newfound respect for the narrator of my favorite show.
I will say that if people are listening and you've never heard of the Hilarious House of Frightenstein, go to YouTube. There's not tons there, but there are some there, and you'll get the vibe of it. It's funny because, first of all, I was born and raised in Hamilton, and they shot it here, and it was all done within 10 minutes of my house, pretty much. But they brought Vincent Price in for one day.
To do that opening monologue?
To do the opening and the closing and a couple little bumpers in between and stuff like that, and that was it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, they brought him in for one
day. And what a coup to get Vincent Price for that, too.
My favorite, of course, was the physicist.
That guy.
They brought the doctor on who played it. He was just deadpan, and I don't think he intended to be anything but. Like, he was an actual physicist.
Yeah, he was fantastic.
It was just amazing. They brought him on, and for 5 minutes of every episode, he'd just teach you some basic lesson of physics. I'm positive it's because they got an education grant somewhere along the way and had to satisfy it.
But he was perfect.
Yeah.
And riveting, just an intense personality where it's like, oh God, if I look away, you're going to wrap the back of my hand with a chalk brush.
You've instantly become one of my best friends by liking Hilarious House of Frankenstein. I don't know what's wrong with Diane Wilde. I have no idea, but I've been trying for years.
Oh, did she not like it?
I don't think she, first of all, I don't think she saw it. And I think if she watched it now, she probably, I can't imagine that she'd be a great fan of it.
Yeah. And there was another show, when I moved to Vancouver, I grew up in North Vancouver, and we had this cable access show that would come on Friday nights called Soundproof. And it was these two guys who were in their late teens, early 20s, who were the hosts, Buzz and Dave, and it was a video show. And while all the rest of the country was getting Good Rockin' Tonight, we got Soundproof, and they would play the most incredible, just raddest, Replacements and The Residents and Oingo Boingo and just Bauhaus and just really, really, really cool stuff that wasn't getting exposure anywhere else. And so it was, again, another great education as a kid to be exposed to all of that really cool music.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that indie stations were great for in television. I'm curious to know, and I'm totally sidetracking here because I often do that. My mind goes in 65 different directions at once.
That's all right.
We talked a bit earlier. You were talking a bit earlier when you were talking about Bit, and you were talking about space. You're talking about how they wanted to appeal to more female audience. Diane and I have talked on the podcast so many times now about the disparity between women in the creative side of the industry in Canada. And there was a report that came out last year, which was frightening in terms of the low numbers there. Is this something in your mind that's being looked at right now? Is it something that people are actually concerning themselves with or doing anything realistically about?
Yes, definitely. And the flip to that too is having diversity.
Sure.
In the industry as well. So, you know, I feel like, and I could be totally wrong, that the diverse question is far lagging behind the gender balance in the rooms.
Sure.
And so, you know, last year I had, other than myself and Karen Hill, who was, who had done an episode for us freelance, and Julia Cohen, who had done an episode for us freelance, my staff was, I had a male room, and that was just how it shook out.
Yeah.
I interviewed a lot of people, and those were the best candidates to come into the room. Ironically enough, though, in last season, in terms of how our cast balance was, the writer's room mirrored the cast pretty much. Like, there was Laura and then a whole lot of men. And we had a couple other female cast members, but it was just sort of an odd way that the cast and the room mirrored each other. And now, again, this year, I have Jen Engels is in our writer's room, and more women on the cast, but I also have a lot of men on the cast. And I'm not saying like women can only write for women and men can only write for men. The men that I have are, you know, incredible writers and can land voices no problem whatsoever. But I guess I have felt it a couple times. But what's hurt me more, the gender thing has never hurt me.
It's more the diversity of voices. I mean, when you're in
terms too, it's like, I've already got a woman, I've already hired a woman. And so that box is ticked. Yeah, right. Yeah. So it's, oh, okay. Well, I think I bring more to the table than just that, but I get it. If you want to make sure that your room is, that you have full representation in your room and you already have somebody who is kind of like me, I get why you wouldn't want to hire another version of me. The thing that hurts me the most in this country is the tax credit situation. That we have a situation here where if I'm from BC and there's a show out in Toronto and they are an Ontario-based show, they will want to hire Ontario-based writers. Even right. If I say, hey, I'll bring myself out there and I'll put myself up, there's a tax credit situation here. And it is very helpful to the show that they're able to access money that way. Incredibly helpful to the show. It's just very limiting when you're putting together the pieces of your show that you are then looking at who's the best person for this chair, but who's the best person from this province for that chair.
Sure.
And there are times where it's just like, the show puts that aside and makes concessions to bring in people from across provinces. But it's horse trading trying to do that. And it hasn't happened to me that often, but it's happened a couple times where it's like, you know, sorry, you're from BC. So I can't even look at you because I don't want to know if,
yeah,
I don't want to be heartbroken that I can't hire you because you're not from here.
When you're talking about a creative industry,
yeah,
and you have to restrict, you possibly have to restrict creativity because of geographic location.
Yeah.
That's a challenging thing.
Yeah. And we make it work. Yeah. And, you know, thankfully there are, because we're actually an interprovincial co-production. So we are BC, Ontario.
Okay.
So we do make it work, but, within it does put some parameters and some challenges on how you are able to make that work.
So maybe you can tell me, I couldn't get this out of Dennis Heaton when I spoke to him. Maybe I didn't phrase it correctly.
Ply him with bourbon in advance.
That's true. And you've led me right up. See, I totally forgot. So before I get to the question I want to ask you, it's late in the episode, but we must have a beverage update. As soon as you mentioned bourbon, you reminded me of that. But I will tell you that first, I am enjoying probably one of the last of the season, Tim Hortons frozen lemonade products. I believe artisanally crafted from the lemon tree out back of the Tim Hortons, which doesn't actually exist. It's a farm
just
to
owned by Burger King.
Yeah. Farm to table, frozen lemonade by Tim Hortons.
Right.
So that's
yeah.
what I'm enjoying. I'm wondering if you have a beverage update to contribute.
I'm having some of Toronto's finest tap water that I believe was purified through a Brita prior to being poured into a delightful floral printed glass.
Wow.
Yes.
So I bet you there's somewhere out there, there's a blog about Brita water filters that could actually break down where the charcoal was made and tell you.
I think it was from the Alpines in France.
There you go.
Let's just say. Yeah.
The charcoal mines of Burgundy.
Yes.
Yes. So there we go. Our beverage update. I had to get that out of the way. Thank you for reminding me with the bourbon. So tell me, for the past 6 or 7 years, I see you down here as being co-producer, co-executive producer, executive producer. I don't know how many other types of producers are there. Can you explain
what they mean?
Yeah, you're executive producer on Bitten right now, which to me has to mean that's the shit, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay. So co-producer means that you have some autonomy in the story department, and you will probably get to go to set with your episode.
Okay.
But you might not get to make a lot of decisions when you're on set. You'll probably have another producer on the floor with you. But you're also seeing your episode through prep with the showrunner. So you're sitting next to the showrunner and in all the prep meetings, so locations and props and wardrobe and all of that, and you're learning that side of things. You're not just in the story room breaking story and rewriting scripts. You're actually taking part in the production machine. The next one up?
I don't know.
There's some sort of like consulting producer means you come into the room and you help break story. But sometimes that means that you just come in for 6 weeks or something and you help them break a number of episodes and you take one away and you write that one. Okay. Supervising producer means you're on the floor with your episode and you're going to be in prep with your episode and you're slightly higher up the totem pole than a co-producer. Co-executive producer is often the person who's the right hand of the showrunner. So that person is, again, empowered with more responsibility as well. They'll give notes on edit cuts. They'll help the showrunner rewrite more stuff. They'll be on the floor more. They will have say in casting a little bit more.
Okay.
They'll be able to kick their opinion in on casting. So it's just, you know, you're basically just stepping up and up and more responsibility and more empowerment.
When I see those credits roll until like 14 minutes into the episode now, I so desperately want to know what each person does.
Half of those credits are probably writers and the other half are the money side of things,
right.
The financiers and the people who put together the financial structure of the show and who deal with the business side of things as well.
Sure.
So yeah, like on an American show, because they have big writers' rooms too. Like that's why you're ripping through 20 different producers.
Oh yeah, like when I'm watching an episode of, for instance, The Good Wife, and we're coming back from the first commercial breaks at the 13-minute mark, and we come back and we're at the 16th or 17th minute, and we've still got credits crawling on the bottom of the screen. I'm just like, what the heck is going on here?
I think that they have a fairly modest size writer's room too. I think there's maybe only about seven or eight people at the most in the Good Wife writer's room. But if you look at something like Private Practice or, you know, any of the Shonda Rhimes shows, I think that they have usually two showrunners, like Grey's Anatomy. They'll have two showrunners and then they've split their writer's room into these two teams because there's just so many scripts that they have to write.
Yeah.
So they kind of leapfrog these two showrunners and their teams will leapfrog each other through the season.
Wow. That's even crazier. But
that's when a 10 episode
run
is a dream.
10 episodes. It's the binary season, basically.
Yeah.
It's either on or off. So
one for every finger.
There you go.
Yeah.
For fans of Bitten going into season two, I don't want you to tell too much, but what are some of the things that they can look forward to going into season two?
We kicked the season off fairly soon after the end of season one, and there is the hunt for Malcolm Danvers. It's a lot about revenge for what's happened in season one, and then things kind of take a left turn.
Ooh.
When a new element to the show.
There we go.
Yeah. Which I've already sort of given that spoiler away at the top of the.
But that's okay.
The conversation.
If someone makes them an offer we can't refuse, that's what we're looking for. Thanks so much for coming on this week. Thanks for, first of all, one, telling me what the producers do. But two, thank you for being the first person who loves Frightenstein as much as I do.
Well, we've got our own two-person fan club then.
That's true. There is a website, though.
We can spread the word. Yeah. More people need to know.
Yeah, we need to start up a hashtag.
Yeah, I'm going to start writing it into Bitten so that characters reference it more.
I think it needs to be on the TV in the background of a bit in episode.
If we could do that, that would be amazing. Just, what are you guys doing? Are you going out for revenge? No. Hilarious House of Frankenstein is on. We're going to stay in and watch it.
Wolfman Jack.
Yeah, they're like, look it. It's a wolfman right there. Uncle Jack.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the TV ABCs podcast, the one that comes up every 2 weeks in between myself, Greg David, and Diane Wild talking about Canadian television at large. We hope that you're enjoying these podcasts. We'd also hope that if you're interested and you find some value in doing so, you could visit our Patreon page, which is at patreon.com/TV_EH, and decide whether you'd be interested in, kicking a little value for value towards our way for these podcasts, kind of help the podcast get better, hopefully let us reach out to more people, all of that stuff, and hopefully, as the hosting demands become a huge requirement, we'll be able to help pay for those things as well. You can find the TVA Twitter account at TV_EH. You can find all of the other podcasts that I do at anthonymarco.com. You can find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. Please feel free to get in touch if you want to. We will take all criticisms, positive and negative, about this show, and let us know if there's some people that you would like us to reach out to and try an interview for upcoming episodes of the TV ABC's version of the TVA podcast. That wraps up another episode for this week, and now back to your regularly scheduled programming.